From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. President Trump says he's willing to talk to Iran, but at the same time, he's warning of dire consequences if Iran escalates tensions with the U.S. Here's the president on NBC's Meet the Press yesterday.
I'm not looking for war, and if there is, it'll be obliteration like you've never seen before. But I'm not looking to do that, but you can't have a nuclear weapon.
White House advisor Jared Kushner plans to present a $50 billion Middle East prosperity plan at an economic conference in Bahrain this week. He told Reuters he wants to create an environment where businesses can thrive and capital can be invested.
You're not just giving people fish like we've been doing here for a long time. You're teaching them to fish, and then you're buying them fishing rods, and you're helping them become something that will be much more sustainable.
Turkey's ruling party suffers a stinging defeat in mayoral elections in Istanbul, and the Senate votes to block the U.S. from selling arms to Saudi Arabia as President Trump brushes off the kingdom's role in the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. This hour on Point, our global roundtable returns for a look at the stories moving the world. And you can join us. How do you feel about Iran after this weekend's developments? What's the right way forward when it comes to a Mideast peace plan? Can economic stimulation there work before political peace is achieved? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us today for this roundtable from Washington is Michael Crowley, now a White House correspondent for The New York Times, where he covers foreign policy. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Michelle Kaczynski, senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN, joining us from Washington as well. Michelle, it's good to have you back.
Hello. Happy to be here.
And with us from Istanbul, Turkey, is Peter Kenyon, international correspondent for NPR. He's based in Turkey. Peter, it's great to have you on Point.
Well, thanks, Meghna, for having me.
Let's first start off with all the developments around the United States and Iran. Michelle, let me just kick off with you here. What do you make of the president and his posture right now, and Iran also saying that it could shoot down another U.S. drone if necessary? Where are we?
Well, we've been hearing both sides for weeks now saying that they don't want war. War is not possible. And you hear the president say that again over the weekend, but then say, oh, but it will be obliteration, by the way, if that happens. So we're hearing both things. We're seeing the United States emphasize that war is not the desired outcome to the tensions that have been simmering for such a long time. But there are many who see the U.S.'s actions as leading directly, in the words of some sources of U.S. allies, to where we are today, and in fact, exacerbating the situation. So it's not like there's a perfect answer as to how to handle Iran's behaviors and what to do, but there's a real question as to whether Iran would be doing the things today that it is doing if the U.S. hasn't taken a series of actions in quick succession, starting with leaving the Iran nuclear deal and then imposing more sanctions, et cetera, et cetera. And now here we are this week with threats of another shootdown and more sanctions looming. And it's hard to see any of the tensions lessening, even as you hear the president saying he doesn't want war.
Right. And so the president may be saying that. But to your point, all the actions around him might be pointing in a different direction, including people around him, fellow politicians. Here, for example, is Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton telling Fox News on Sunday, yesterday, that he hopes the president's statement that the U.S. won't tolerate any attacks on American personnel, quote, gets through to the leaders in Tehran.
I think retaliatory strikes were warranted when we were talking about foreign vessels on the high seas. I think they were warranted against an American unmanned aircraft. What I see is Iran steadily marching up the escalation chain. It started out with threats. It went to an attack on vessels in ports. It went to an attack on vessels at sea. Now it's an unmanned American aircraft. I fear that if Iran doesn't have a firm set of boundaries drawn around its behavior, we're going to see an attack on a U.S. ship or U.S. manned aircraft.
That's Republican Senator Tom Cotton yesterday. Peter, let me turn to you there in Istanbul. According to Tom Cotton, he sees this all as Iran's provocation. How is that viewed, from where you are?
Well, certainly, I keep track of what the Iranians are saying, and they view it quite differently, obviously. I mean, Mohammad Javad Zarif, the foreign minister, just today is saying, we are ready to resist this American pressure campaign with full power. That's a typical robust but not very specific kind of rhetoric that Iranian officials sometimes use when they're under pressure. I think clearly, as Michelle noted, they would not have pieces of a U.S. drone in the water to be collected after being shot down if this pressure campaign hadn't been ratcheted up by the Trump administration. I don't think Iran would have initiated that kind of action. But that is where we are today. And now that they're there, they are being defiant and saying we could do it again. And meanwhile, the sanctions are in place. More are coming. They're all unilateral sanctions, by the way. None of the other signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal, Germany, Britain, France, Russia, China, they're not going along with any of this. And yet, here we are today, and it doesn't seem like there's a clear path to de-escalation.
Okay, interesting. So, Michael, I want to turn to you on this because there's also this question of how influential the president's closest advisors are in this moment. And this is something that you reported on very recently. But first, let's listen to the president himself telling NBC's Chuck Todd in an interview on Meet the Press yesterday that he would be willing to talk to Iran. No strings attached.
No preconditions.
And you'll talk anyway?
Here it is. Look, you can't have nuclear weapons. And if you want to talk about it, good. Otherwise, you can live in a shattered economy for a long time to come.
Do you feel like you were being pushed into military action against Iran by any of your advisors?
I have two groups of people. I have doves and I have hawks.
Yeah, you have some serious
hawks.
Oh,
yeah. John Bolton is absolutely a hawk. It's up to him. He'd take on the whole world at one time, okay? But that doesn't matter. Because I want both sides.
That's the president yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press. Now, Michael, the president mentioning John Bolton there, but right now, should we be talking more about Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and his influence in this moment?
Well, I do think so. I co-wrote a story about Pompeo for Sunday's paper with my colleague Ed Wong. And Pompeo and Bolton were two of the more forceful voices around the table calling for President Trump to take some kind of retaliatory action against Iran to punish these Iranian provocations, including the shoot down of the drone and the attacks on the oil tankers. Bolton in particular, but also Pompeo, do have hawkish views of foreign policy, are not shy about the use of American force, are not less than many other people who Trump talks to, don't see the downsides of American action, don't see the risk first. They see the reward of military action. And what's interesting is that, you know, they seem to have gotten Trump to the point where he was willing to pull the trigger on this military strike against Iran on Thursday night. And then the president, at the very last minute, changed his mind, as we know, stopped the attack. We don't know exactly what the impetus for that was. The president has given, and people around him have given, different explanations. But when it comes to Pompeo, you have a Secretary of State who is very close to the president, enormously influential, particularly in a period of time when the Defense Department, which hasn't had a confirmed secretary since Jim Mattis mm-hmm. left on the 1st of January, is not much of a rival power center of its own. Pompeo is sort of asserting his influence and authority both publicly and privately. But in this case, has he kind of pushed it too far? Is the president resentful? Does he feel like the hawks around him are trying to get him into the kind of Middle East conflict that he essentially campaigned against? But the last thing I would say, which is noteworthy, is that while Trump often mentions Bolton and makes jokes both publicly and privately about Bolton as kind of wanting to take on the world and, you know, being this uber hawk, he never does talk that way about Pompeo in public, and you didn't hear him say it in that interview yesterday. And I think that there's something noteworthy about that. Maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think Pompeo's standing is safe with the president for now. They have a better personal relationship than Trump does with Bolton. Also worth noting that Pompeo has a very good relationship with Ivanka Trump and her husband, Jared. Uh-huh. So it will be interesting to see whether he is able to continue to navigate those politics and continue to make a hawkish case without alienating the president.
So, Michelle, let me turn to you, because we were having this discussion as Mike Pompeo is going to meet or with Saudi officials, Saudi leaders today. So what is he hoping to achieve in these meetings? May he be successful? And how is that going to play into the tensions with Iran?
Yeah, well, he has a lot to do on this trip. So talking with the Saudis, you know, the U.S. has wanted to cement this relationship with the Saudis, seemingly at all costs in terms of how the public views this in light of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. They want to preserve this relationship and make sure nothing fails in it and that there aren't chinks. Again, despite this brutal murder, because the U.S. needs Saudi Arabia to try to meet its goals in the region, to counter Iran, you could say first and foremost, but also for the other desired jewel in its crown, forging Mideast peace. The Saudis are really key to this. So that those will be the big topics. And to Michael's point, and Pompeo has a lot of influence with the president. We know that. We know that their relationship is strong. But it's also hard to say that Pompeo really has an overarching foreign policy plan or really like a foreign policy point of view. It's hard to see that. You see him sometimes clearly saying what the president wants to hear, but also at other times having a point of view of his own. And so as he's on this trip, this important trip where he's going to be making several stops, one of them being in Jeddah, he talked about the importance of maritime security in light of what's been going on with Iran. And he said that one of the goals of the U.S. stance right now is to guarantee freedom of ships passing through the Strait of Hormuz. But then this morning, we see the president tweeting, what are we doing protecting other ships out there? Why can't they do it themselves? So that's one more instance where you see some odd daylight between what the president says and what his own Secretary of State is saying.
Right. I mean, as you know, the president tweeted, why are we protecting the shipping lanes for other countries many years for zero compensation? So we'll talk more about all the things going on in the world news, but particularly, of course, in the Middle East when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about all that's happening in the week ahead in news around the world, particularly between the United States and Iran, and also Jared Kushner in Bahrain for a Middle East peace conference. The G20 is coming up as well. I'm joined today by Peter Kenyon. He's the international correspondent for NPR based in Istanbul, Turkey, and he's joining us from Istanbul today. Michelle Kaczynski is also with us. She's senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN, and Michael Crowley is also with us. He's White House correspondent for the New York Times. They are both joining us from Washington. Let's listen very briefly to some reactions to, or at least one reaction to, how the president's been handling the situation with Iran. Here's California Democratic Senator and 2020 presidential candidate Kamala Harris. She told CBS's Face the Nation yesterday that the president, in her view, has no one to blame but himself for the current tension with Iran.
I don't believe that anyone should receive credit for a crisis of their own making. There is no question in my mind that the current occupant of the White House, President Trump, put in place a series of events that led to that event.
That's Senator Kamala Harris yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation. Let's go to Doug, who's calling from Los Alamos, New Mexico. Doug, you're on the air.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I wish to point out that Iran was one of the earliest signers of the Treaty on Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, we call the NPT. That means it has promised to only develop nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. Now, after the Iran-Iraq war, they did start a clandestine weapons research program, which they ended in 2003. They've been under IAEA inspections from when they first joined the NPT, and now they're subject to the strictest inspections that the IAEA has ever put on any country.
So, Doug, given all that, sorry to interrupt, maybe you were just getting to the point, but given all what you just said, what do you think, how do you think the U.S. or the Trump administration should be handling this moment?
Well, we should have stayed in the JCPOA, which is the formal initials for the Iran deal, but we didn't. We should get back into it and release some of the sanctions. But, I mean, nobody calls me from the White House to ask.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for your call. Peter Kenyon, you know, a little earlier we talked about, we played that tape of where the president's saying, you know, he's willing to talk with Iran. What kind of door, if any, could that open in terms of future negotiations between the United States and Tehran?
Well, saying that by itself doesn't really open up any doors. The Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, is already on record multiple times saying pulling out of the nuclear deal just shows us that the Americans' word cannot be trusted. There's no point in talking with them on any subject, and that's particularly true, he has said, of this administration. So the chances of him changing his mind quickly on that point seem quite slim.
And Michael Crowley, before we leave the issue of U.S. And Iran tensions, what do we know about these reports that the United States may have used a cyber attack in retaliation for that Iran shooting down that U.S. drone?
I think we've seen a lot of reporting, including in the New York Times, suggesting strongly that this did in fact happen. And I think it's an important part of this story. It's entirely possible that we may proceed into a conflict with Iran that is really unlike any the United States has waged to date, which is to say that it's a kind of shadow war, a cyber war, that we will not be firing missiles and dropping bombs and shooting down planes, but in fact zapping computer systems and networks. This particular attack was reportedly targeted against systems that Iranian systems that had helped to contribute to the attacks on the oil tankers off of Iran's coast. But it is possible that there could be more. The Times reported over the weekend that the U.S. is examining other options. Now, this sounds all well and good. Listeners may think that, you know, America is highly technologically advanced and has sort of all the best computers and programmers. But in fact, Iran has very sophisticated cyber capabilities and they have used them, including against American targets. So this is, you know, quite dangerous. It is not the case that a cyber conflict would be safe and harmless and sort of a matter of one-upsmanship as opposed to outright military action with guns and bombs. You can shut down power grids that could affect hospitals, nursing homes, banking systems, cause all kinds of total chaos. So there's a strong possibility that that's the path we are headed down, possibly as an alternative to or in tandem with a traditional military action, and it's an important part of this story.
Right. And more and more often people consider cyber war to be war. There might not be bloodshed, but it's still damaging and it still raises those tensions.
No, I think it's a very, very important point. I mean, a couple of years ago, I had a conversation with a former inspector general for the NSA, and his particular concern was how much how we have so many soft targets for cyber warfare here in the United States that, for example, you know, our all of our electricity grids are actually on the public internet. So, indeed, that's a huge, huge topic, which I actually want us as a program to take a look at in the coming days and weeks. But let's also just keep ourselves focused at the moment on other news coming out of the Middle East, because we're also taking a look at the White House unveiling a $50 billion Mideast economic plan. ahead of this economic workshop in Bahrain. And White House advisor Jared Kushner told Reuters in an interview published on Saturday that the money won't just go to the West Bank and Gaza, but will also be used to stimulate the economies of Jordan, Egypt, and Lebanon.
If you can get that whole region starting to lift and you're able to get, you know, quicker flow of goods, quicker flow of people, and all of the different areas that are necessary in industry instead of, you know, bullets and munitions and war, then I think that will really lead to a big increase in investment in the area and more jobs and better quality of life and hopefully more peace along with it.
Now, remember, this is the economic portion of a peace plan that was supposedly years in the making. Yesterday, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas said he expects this week's economic summit to fail because the fundamental political question of Palestinian statehood, in his view, still dwarfs everything else.
The Bahrain workshop came to solve the problem. What problem? The economic problem? But there's a political problem. Economic problem of whom? For example, when they say we want to give the Palestinians an amount of money, who are the Palestinians? They should have an entity, a statehood. So you need to first recognize the state, and then after that you can say that this state needs this and that.
That's Mahmoud Abbas, of course, speaking there through a translator. Michelle, is this... Bahrain meeting. I don't want to say is it DOA, but
I was just going to say, are you going to say is it doomed to fail? But you just don't want to say that.
Yes,
it does sound that way because, and I'm happy when you started talking about it that you didn't call it a peace plan. You called it the economic plan because it is very, very difficult to see how peace comes out of this plan. They wanted to start with the economic piece to try to say to the Palestinians, basically, this is what you're going to get. Everybody knows at this point from what's leaked out of the deliberations that this is not going to have a state necessarily for Palestinians. I mean, the White House has pretty much refused to talk about a two-state solution at this point. And the last time Jared Kushner was talking about it, he said, well, we don't need to say that. We don't need to talk about that right now. So we all kind of know what's coming for the Palestinians and that they're not going to like it. So in the meantime, they're trying to say, oh, but look at all this investment that you could have, billions and billions of dollars. And yes, investment would improve the situation. And it could forge out a better future for Palestinian people. But their whole cause, they're not going to just give up on statehood at this point. At least that's what all indicators are right now. So looking in on this, analysts say, furthermore, who is going to invest? Who's
right.
going to want to put a lot of money in at this point before we know really anything solid about the political part of your plan? So it's a very strange way of laying this out. You see what they're trying to do, but nobody really seems to be jumping on board with it except for the White House kind of cheering the potential outcomes of it.
Yeah. So, Peter, let me follow up on that because I think Michelle's making a very good point that it seems as if the White House is making the argument that potentially political stability could come following economic investment. But I'm not sure I know of very many investors on that level who like to put their money in places that aren't stable. So, I mean, is this
– I think you put your finger on it. No, I think you put your finger on it. This sort of cart before the horse argument, you know, how do you get economic improvements up and running in any kind of an environment that isn't politically stable? I just don't see how that happens. I mean, when I lived in Jerusalem, it was a long time ago, Second Intifada, just the fact of people talking about economic plans and maybe someday a peace plan, you know, that's an improvement over those days. But I have yet to hear anything that seems like it's really going to fly.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Nicholas, who's calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Hi. So just earlier, we're talking about how Iran says the United States can't be trusted. And I mean, Israel and Palestine are neighbors to Iran. They're seeing what's going on in the Middle East. So in what way is there any credibility for the administration, the Trump administration, in getting this off the ground?
Nicholas, thank you so much for your call. Michael, do you want to respond to that?
Well, that is the case that the Palestinians make at this point. They say that the U.S. is an entirely unfair broker, in their view, completely aligned with Israel. You have to remember that Donald Trump actually made Israeli officials nervous, as I believe as a candidate and soon after his inauguration, by using language to the effect that you know, he was going to be very even-handed and he wasn't necessarily on board with the Israeli view of the conflict. But in the months since then, he has been very closely aligned with the Israelis on key policy issues. Palestinians now feel like the U.S. is not an honest broker. That has long been a challenge for the United States, to be seen as having some kind of impartiality or ability to bring the two sides together without seeming totally biased. And although many American administrations have been accused by the Palestinians of being pro-Israel, I think in this case, the Palestinians feel like it's really, from their perspective, as bad as it's ever been. And so that's a huge challenge. A counterweight to that is that the Trump administration has developed very close ties, for better or worse, with some Arab governments, including Saudi Arabia, notably, that have at times given indications that they would be supportive of pressuring the Palestinians and supporting the Trump position, because those Arab governments also happen to be closer in many ways to Israel than they have been for decades. But I still don't think that that all adds up to a scenario where it's really plausible at this point to imagine that there's a breakthrough deal that the Palestinians are on board with.
Yeah. So we're going to talk more about the Saudis in a couple of minutes. But Peter, I wanted to turn to you because you are there in Istanbul, Turkey, and we've got some pretty big news coming right out of Istanbul and major in the mayoral leadership in Istanbul. What's happening there?
Well, yes, this was a shock, a real shock for our president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for the Turkish president. His candidate, a former prime minister, lost quite badly to the opposition. And this was a rerun because Erdogan's party had objected to the original vote back in late March. They got it thrown out. Yesterday was the rerun. And I went and talked to some voters. And they were ready to send a message. I mean, this opposition candidate, Ekrem İmamoğlu, just squeaked through with 13,000 votes in late March. This time he had like an 800,000 vote lead. And the people I talked to were angry at having, to vote over again. And some of the polling showed even ruling party voters, even İmamoğlu's opponents, even Erdogan's friends were not turning out to vote because they were disgusted with what was happening. So this time it seems Erdogan is accepting the results. He has congratulated İmamoğlu. He'll be the new mayor, it looks like. It doesn't necessarily mean relations will be very smooth going forward. Clearly, though, overall, this is a setback for Erdogan. He seemed untouchable in Turkish politics in recent years. Now he doesn't face voters himself till 2023, but what happens between now and then is going to be quite interesting.
So, Peter, can you tell us a little bit more? Because can it be seen as, at least within Istanbul, on a referendum of how Erdogan has been leading? I mean, he's a very strong and strong-armed leader of Turkey.
Well, sure. He was very, very keen to get Istanbul back in the ruling party's column. That's why he went to all this trouble to challenge the initial results and get it done over again, only to lose by a much greater margin. So clearly the message has been sent. As one voter told me, we've been sending him these messages for some time now. I wonder if he's listening.
Michelle, do you have a thought on the Istanbul mayoral election?
Yeah, I think that when you consider that Istanbul is Erdogan's hometown and his party dominated it for 25 years. To see this change happening, I think it will be fascinating to see how Erdogan now, between today and the next couple of years, has to change his tune somewhat, has to reform some things. When you consider the tens of thousands of people that he's either fired or jailed following the coup attempt, and the fact that the economy has been struggling and people are looking for a better way of doing things, how much pressure this puts on Erdogan to change things there. That's what we'll be watching for. Mm.
And Michael, we've got about a minute to go before we take a break. Just wanted to hear you on your thoughts on the Istanbul elections.
Well, I guess my thoughts are broader, and I'm thinking about the G20 summit in Japan later this week. I'll be headed there tomorrow. President Trump will likely see Erdogan. And, his fate is very relevant to the U.S. because he has, Erdogan is in this very complicated position where he sits on the border between East and West. He has been flirting with closer ties with Russia, buying a Russian air defense missile system that the United States is very upset about because it brings Russian technology into the NATO alliance. Of course, Turkey is a NATO ally, and the Trump administration is not happy with the Erdogan regime's support for various Islamist actors in the Middle East. So it's a very complicated and fraught relationship, and the strength and weakness of Erdogan has very important strategic implications for the United States in its dealings with the Middle East and also with Russia and the unity of the NATO alliance.
Well, we are talking this hour about a lot of news on the world stage this week. Michael Crowley, Michelle Kaczynski, and Peter Kenyon join us, and we want to hear from you. What's your view on the United States relationship with Saudi Arabia? Also, what do you want to see coming out of the G20? As Michael just mentioned, the president, President Trump and President Xi are set to meet on the sidelines of the G20 there. Can we have a reduction in trade tensions between the U.S. and China? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about a whole bunch of news on the world stage coming up this week. And joining us is Peter Kenyon. He's with us from Istanbul, Turkey. He is international correspondent for NPR. Michelle Kaczynski is also with us. She's senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN. And Michael Crowley joins us. He's White House correspondent for The New York Times. And Michael and Michelle are with us from Washington. What do you think can be accomplished in the upcoming G20 meeting, especially as President Trump and China's President Xi are set to meet face-to-face? Well, let's listen to a little bit of an interview that aired on Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press, and host Chuck Todd asked President Trump why he's overruled Congress to allow more arms sales to Saudi Arabia, even after continued human rights abuses, such as the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
This is a vicious, hostile place. If you're going to look at Saudi Arabia, look at Iran, look at other countries, I won't mention names, and take a look at what's happening. And then you go outside of the Middle East and you take a look at what's happening with countries, okay? And I only say they spend $400 to $450 billion over a period of time, all so money, all jobs, buying
that's
equipment.
That's the price. As long as they keep buying, you'll overlook some of this behavior.
But I'm not like a fool that says we don't want to do business with them. And by the way, if they don't do business with us, you know what they do? They'll do business with the Russians or with the Chinese.
That's the president on Meet the Press on Sunday. And it was a little hard to hear, but Chuck Todd tried to get in the statement, so long as they keep buying, they being the Saudis, you'll overlook some of this behavior. The president then said, no, no. Let's go to Samuel, who's calling from Natick, Massachusetts. Samuel, you're on the air.
Hi, ladies and gentlemen, fellow citizens. I have a very simple question, which is a component of moral and legal arguments. One, given what we know about Iran, at least within the last 40 years of my life. I have not seen Iran attack any country. All I hear is words, accusations of accusations. Given what we know today and know to be fact.
Well, just to jump in here, Iran did have a war with Iraq. So just.
But it was not Iran that started it. Like if you want to argue on that, go back and check the data. Now, the question I'm asking today we know that a citizen, a permanent resident of the United States of America, which is what I will call our fellow citizens, working for the Washington Post, if I'm correct on that, mm-hmm. got murdered, brutally dismembered, chopped off, carried in bags,
yeah.
and disposed, thrown away. I mean, this is the moral. This is something that nobody can even equivocally even. It's chilling.
Yeah. Well, Samuel, thank you so much for your call. So, Michelle Kaczynski, you think the point Samuel's getting to there is one of questioning why is it that the United States, historically, but of course, especially under the Trump administration, has such a favorable view of Saudi Arabia versus its pretty hostile view of Iran?
Because of their view as an ally, a strong, stable ally in that region, and the U.S. can rely on it for all kinds of forms of security. And earlier when we were talking about the, possibly bringing Mideast peace finally, and that's what the Trump administration thinks that it can accomplish, it relies on Saudi Arabia to, in essence, buy out the Palestinians. The U.S. thinks that Saudi Arabian money in large scale can convince the Palestinians to take on this plan that we haven't fully seen yet. There's lots of doubt that could happen, but that's one more thing that Saudi Arabia can accomplish. And countering Iran in the immediate sense is the other point. So to hear the president talk about, when he was asked about supporting Saudi Arabia in light of the murder, and his explanation is, well, look at what others do. It's just one more case of this administration doing a bad job of handling a case that shocked the world. And that's why you see members of Congress, even in his own party, wanting to stop arms sales to Saudi Arabia, wanting there to be a real rebuke from this administration, which we have not seen in regard to the Khashoggi murder. Just last week, the U.S. From the State Department put out its annual report on human trafficking, and the Secretary of State, against the information from his own State Department, against the opinion and the final conclusion of his own experts, did not want to put Saudi Arabia on the list for using child soldiers. It's one more time that we see the administration shy away from even what some would consider a perfunctory rebuke of Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. for anything. Mm. I mean, the administration will say, well, we sanctioned certain people that Saudi Arabia said were responsible for the murder. Like, okay, well, you can see the problems with that. And, when you hear the State Department talk about the biggest offenders in terms of something like human trafficking, they won't even name Saudi Arabia, uh-huh. even though it's one of the biggest offenders. And religious freedom, it won't even out loud mention Saudi Arabia being one of the worst offenders in the world.
Yeah.
So to hear Trump explain this way, it's one more moment for critics to jump on there and say this is beyond the pale.
But if I can jump in for a second, it's also a very tidy illustration here of Donald Trump's worldview. He's yeah. highly transactional.
Exactly.
Who's buying and selling to who, and who's mm-hmm. making money? And he's not interested in human rights. He's not interested particularly in how countries govern their internal affairs. He does sometimes invoke that theme when it is convenient, for instance, when he's denouncing Iran or North Korea. So he will sometimes selectively talk about a way a government treats its own people, but it's in the service of another purpose. Generally speaking, human rights are not interesting to him. What is interesting is doing deals, making money, and some kind of fundamental question of you know, sort of, are you quote unquote on our side or not? So in this case, the Saudis are on our side when it comes to Iran and other issues in the Middle East from Trump's perspective.
Right. And what even members of his own party have such a problem with is, isn't the United States supposed to be the example and the force in the world that furthers these values, these democratic values? And President Trump seems to be willing to walk away from them when money and U.S. jobs are involved, even when the, you know, he says that he's responsible for the economy doing so great. But we're willing to not address certain values when money's involved.
Yeah. You know, I mean, some might see it as this president being the first president who's just simply honest about U.S. actions, what really drives U.S. actions on the world stage. I mean, I've heard that from plenty of listeners on this show. But Peter, let me pull you back in here, because I wonder, I mean, we're going to get to the G20 in a second, but regarding the United States, you know, very different approaches between Iran and Saudi Arabia, as we've been discussing. To me, one of the places that this comes to a head is, of course, in the war in Yemen, right? And the catastrophe that is what's happening in Yemen. I'm wondering how U.S. allies or the rest of the world looks upon America's approach here as either exacerbating or at least doing nothing to stop what's going on in Yemen.
Well, certainly the European allies are very much at odds with Washington on a number of issues, including how to deal with Iran, of course, and this the conflict in Yemen. I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, the Saudi-led coalition, the Saudis are now about to get more weapons, we're told, from the Americans. The Houthis are getting, which is the other side in the Yemeni conflict, the Houthi rebels are getting their weapons and resources from Iran. So we're seeing the U.S. and Iran engaging essentially in a proxy fight in a desperately poor kingdom in the desert where there is just, there's almost nothing and there's very little reach of government. It really is a tragedy.
Yeah, and I mean, to your point, there's almost nothing, but the one thing there is an oversupply of is human suffering in Yemen right now. But let's turn our attention a little bit here, because I do want to talk about the G20 summit, which is coming up. And President Trump and China's President Xi Jinping are expected to meet during the G20 in Osaka, Japan. And yesterday, China's Vice Commerce Minister Wang Shouwen told reporters what his country hopes to get out of the meeting when it comes to the trade differences between the U.S. and China.
As for China, we stick to the principles of mutual respect, equality, and mutual benefit. Mutual respect means respect for each other's sovereignty. The agreements should be beneficial to both sides, and each side needs to make compromises and concessions.
Michael Crowley, you told us a couple of minutes ago that you're going to be at the G20 here. How much might we hope to come out of this meeting between President Trump and President Xi?
Well, of course, it's difficult to predict, and particularly when you're talking about Donald Trump, it's always dangerous to predict. I would say that expectations here, generally speaking, are on the low side. You know, the trade talks between China and the U.S. Essentially fell apart several weeks ago. And this is significant in that it is a kind of resumption of a dialogue that had halted. So the agreement to meet itself was a significant and positive sign. I think that, you know, what's most plausible is something that looks like the last G20 summit meeting the last summit meeting between Trump and Xi. I believe it might have been the G7. In any case, it was in Buenos Aires late last year. And, you know, essentially what happened was that everyone was on tenterhooks to see whether there would be a breakthrough. What were they going to say about the trade deal? And they came out, offered some happy talk, said that we've agreed to keep negotiating. You know, Trump, I believe, tweeted some positive words and things looked pretty good, but then they fell apart again. And the point here is that this is a very complicated dispute that involves matters of trade, how Japan runs its economy internally, and then there are all kinds of security issues, including, for instance, the Chinese telecoms company Huawei, which the U.S. sees as a kind of stalking horse for the People's Liberation Army. The potential for all of these issues to be ironed out in this one meeting or a few days out in Osaka is basically nil. So it will, I think, fundamentally be a kind of tonal thing. Do they feel like they're on the right track, or did somebody take a position behind closed doors that shows we're not budging, we don't see how we can get from point A to B, and then the markets are really going to, kind of have a freak out.
So, Michelle, I think Michael's right about, let's not put any hope that there'll be a sweeping reduction in tensions between the United States and China based on one meeting between President Trump and President Xi. But actually, it's something else that Michael said earlier makes me wonder. We do know that our president, that President Trump is transactional, as Michael pointed out, but also very relational, right? These personal relationships matter to him a lot.
Well,
is this a possibility?
Yeah. He thinks that the relationships are great and the relationship is going to carry the day. He thought that initially with Xi when he was getting along with him. But it didn't work in the end. He thought that his great relationship with his best friend that he loves, Kim Jong-un, was going to solve that decades-long problem. But guess what? It didn't. So she is a smart person, and he also has an element of the transactional in him. So it's not as if he's going to smile at Trump and they're going to shake hands and all is going to be mended. So the last time, the last round of talks where people were pinning so much optimism because it seemed like it was getting to the final stages, China, at the last minute, where the U.S. and China felt that they had an agreement, China really pulled back on certain things. And so there was this huge frustration within the Trump administration that, we were all so close. And then it was, the thought, well, sure enough, China then reneged in the view of the administration on certain points. Those are going to be the sticking points, and it's going to take some time. And I just don't know where exactly they are at this point, how close. But, there was obviously a lot more work that needed to be done to iron those things out. And you're right, the G20 isn't going to solve it. But it is possible that with this, if the desire is there on both sides, they're going to have to eventually reach some conclusion.
Yeah. So, Peter, what are your thoughts on the G20 then?
Well, certainly from here in Istanbul, it's a bit of a different end of the scale. They're much down closer to the bottom of those 20 top economies. But certainly they'll be watching Trump's interactions with various world leaders with great interest. And President Erdogan from Turkey certainly has a long, long list of economic projects that he is trying to get through. I mean, if he has his way, this part of the Bosporus where I'm standing on the shore will look like an island because he's running a whole new canal up towards the Black Sea. But so that's the scale he thinks on.
Okay.
I find it entertaining, too, that climate is going to factor so much into this G20, and that is a huge concern of so many countries around the world. You could say every country around the world, except for the U.S., because we are now the only ones not in the Paris Climate Agreement. But just this weekend, we heard Mike Pence refuse to say that man-made climate change is even a threat. I mean, he refused to say that. And now we're going to go into this G20 where the rest of the world is going to be, represented by these other countries that are there. And that's going to be one of their top concerns.
Well, Michael, you're going. I mean, tell us more about that.
Well, it's one of many ways in which Trump goes to these international gatherings and is sort of isolated and an outlier. And whereas in the past the U.S. was trying to build consensus, Trump is often fighting consensus and sort of poking his fingers in the eyes of other countries. That will also happen on Iran. I saw that Russia is complaining about a talk of newer sanctions on Iran, talking about ways to help Iran survive the growing U.S. sanctions against it. So Trump, once again, is going to be a little bit of an outlier. By the way, speaking of Russia, I just want to flag for listeners that Trump is also likely to see Vladimir Putin at the G20, and that is always very interesting and totally unpredictable. This will be the first meeting between Trump and Putin since the Mueller report has come out. Russia has sent some signs to the effect that, well, all the Mueller stuff is behind you. Let's talk. Let's get along. Let's try to really reset our relations. Is Trump willing to play that game? It will be fascinating to see what kind of rhetoric we hear out of that meeting.
Yeah, and if they speak privately, the world may never know what is even said.
I was just going to say, it depends on who's in the room with them, right? Well, yeah. Michelle Kaczynski, senior diplomatic correspondent for CNN. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Michael Crowley, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you as well. And good luck in Japan, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Great to be here.
And Peter Kenyon, international correspondent for NPR, joining us from Istanbul. Peter, it was great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.